Welcome to the Errata Movie Podcast. Today we have interviews with two filmmakers, the director of the Academy Award-nominated Persepolis, Marjan Satrapi.
I'm a person that is born in a certain place, in a certain time, that has seen things, and these things that she has seen doesn't correspond to the thing that is described in the press.
And screenwriter and director Mike White.
I'm starting to annoy myself. I need to stop being a backseat driver and just like take control of the wheel and see how that goes.
This is Robert Davis. Today we're going to talk about two serious films that fall into categories normally reserved for unserious films. This weekend, of course, are the Academy Awards, and one of the movies nominated for Best Animated Feature Film is a movie called Persepolis by Marjan Satrapi. It's an autobiographical film about her life as a little girl growing up in Iran before, during, and after the Islamic Revolution. Even though it's about childhood and it's animated and it's in this category against Ratatouille and Surf's Up, it's really a film for grown-ups. In fact, I think it's the first film for grown-ups that's ever been nominated in this category, unless you count Corpse Bride. Just after her movie was nominated for an Academy Award, and just a couple of days before she appeared on The Colbert Report with Stephen Colbert, Marjan Satrapi sat down with our own J. Robert Parks to chat about Persepolis. Before we listen to their conversation, we'll hear my chat with screenwriter and director Mike White, whose film Year of the Dog was actually one of my favorites of 2007. It stars Molly Shannon, so I'm a little surprised myself to find that it was one of my favorites, but I'm often intrigued by Mike White's screenplays. He's best known as a screenwriter, of course. He wrote films like Chuck and Buck, The Good Girl, and several films for Jack Black, including School of Rock. And even though these are all comedies, or at least ostensibly, he often experiments with genres or narrative structure, or explores subject matter that's surprising by Hollywood standards. Year of the Dog, I think, is one of the most subversive films I saw come out of Hollywood last year, and it's certainly one of the few mainstream films I can think of that directly discusses thorny issues like animal rights.
So you ever been married?
No. I mean, I never, you know, I guess I never, that never happened, but I think some people just aren't as kind of, you know, I don't know, it's like that, I guess.
We have a dog who needs a home. I thought maybe you might fall in love with him. I'm just desperate because I don't want to see him die. But no pressure.
I love my dog as much as I love you.
Year of the Dog is also the first film that he directed himself, so I was particularly interested to hear about how an established writer needs to adjust his thinking when putting on the hat of a director. Now, this recording of our chat has a little bit of noise in the background because we decided to meet up at a place called Badass Coffee in Park City, Utah during the Sundance Film Festival. So as it's freezing cold outside, you'll hear people wander in, grab some coffee, warm up, and sit down on a couch to listen to our chat. I hope it isn't too distracting. Here's Mike White.
Year of the Dog is a movie about a woman who loses her pet dog that she's really attached to, and how the loss of her dog kind of sends her life in unexpected directions and changes her relationship with the people in her life and herself, basically, in a nutshell.
Now, you've been a filmmaker for a while as a screenwriter and an actor. What made you want to direct?
Well, I've like had a lot of production experience by now, like being on sets of TV shows and running shows and being on movies. And at some point, you're just like, I'm starting to annoy myself. I need to stop being a backseat driver and just like take control of the wheel and see how that goes. And so I wrote this, and it seemed like it was like the size and tone of a movie that I felt like I was like, well, I feel like I can do as good a job on this as anyone else, so might as well just throw my hat into the ring.
So do your scripts typically have a lot of visual instructions, like how the camera is going to move or edits or anything like that?
No, not really. I mean, there have been exceptions to that, but usually, no, I try to like, if I'm not directing it, I feel like I don't want to like you know, cramp the director's style. And at the same time, if I was going to do it, I feel like I don't need to write that to myself. I can kind of figure that stuff out. I mean, some scripts are really written, designed in a very visual way, but that's just, that's not the way I come to things, I guess.
Yeah. So this was sort of new territory to have to think of it and implement it.
But it was the fun part of it because it was new to me and I had a lot of fun on that with those kinds of decisions.
Yeah, I know a lot of screenwriters have a hard time watching directors and actors change their words. Do you have a hard time with that? And also, did you find yourself making modifications as you were working, as you were in production?
What's weird is that I like the idea of being able to let go and be spontaneous and let the actors, you know, kind of add to stuff. And I've worked with actors who definitely do that. And, you know, sometimes I can be mellow about it. And sometimes if it's something that I feel like, it's like ruining the intent of the scene or kind of corrupting the character or, you know, like somewhere it feels like it's like I need to step in and like kind of like insist upon something, I'll do it. But, you know, mostly I've worked with actors who really are respectful of what's on the page and want to do that. But like, I like it when it's messed up, you know. I don't want it to be, you know, it's film. So it's like, you know, it should feel a little messy.
Yeah. Who are some of the actors you've worked with who seem to be especially good at filling out those kinds of character details?
Well, like, obviously, like, I've done a lot of movies with Jack Black, and he's not really a big improviser, but he definitely likes to like change the turn of phrase and that makes it very him.
Yeah.
And obviously when he does that, it makes it funnier, and so I definitely encourage it when he does that, you know.
Right.
And like John Riley's a great improviser, and he's an incredible, you know, at improv. And I think sometimes he feels frustrated on my sets that like there's not more of that. But you know, it's like, it's so like there's so much stuff in the script that you write that you have to cut out, let alone just the sort of tangential stuff that like, you know, somebody improvises on the day. So you have to really kind of choose your battles.
Hmm. Well, how did you arrive at the visual style for the movie?
Well, I was really into this movie. When I first wrote it, I kept thinking of it like I was really influenced by that movie Gates of Heaven, which is an Errol Morris documentary. Yeah. And he does a thing where he really has people almost talking directly to camera. And I just liked the idea of real portraitures, especially for those in the early part of the movie where all the people are sort of talking at her and she's just listening, just like really like letting it stand on the person and being as subjective in those kinds of moments as I could possibly make it, where you really feel like what it would be like when someone is, you know, when you're sitting across the table from someone and they're just talking to you. And that was an idea that I felt like I really wanted to make it very simple and very portraiture-ish and very kind of flat in a sense. Huh.
Did you take thematic inspiration from Gates of Heaven? Because it's also about pets and death of pets.
Yeah, I mean, I like it because it definitely has like, you know, I liked that it was about people who... What really influenced that movie and kind of the idea of some of the ideas of this movie was how it definitely, you feel like it's a lot of obsessional thinking is, you know, you, since it really allows people to sort of kind of like, you can tell he just allows people to sort of talk, you know, and it's not a like, you know, heavy questioning kind of thing where you just like are listening to someone just kind of, you know, stream of consciousness think. Yeah. You really see how kind of people think in these sort of obsessional sort of narrow ways. And that was kind of just this idea as a, you know, an idea for monologues that I just thought that's a kind of cool thing to like really introduce characters where they really, you know, fully have like their moment where they're just kind of like spilling it out.
Stream of consciousness. I always think of that old woman who's talking about there's a car that's rumbling by.
She just goes on forever. That's like a classic.
She's perfect.
Scene. Yeah, she's awesome.
Do you remember the first time you saw Gates of Heaven? Because that's on DVD now, but it's for a while it was pretty hard to see.
Actually, the first time I was in film school, or not film school, I was in school and I had taken, I took one film class and they actually showed the clip, that one clip.
Oh, really?
And I hadn't seen the movie, but I just saw that thing. I thought it was so funny. I was like, so I went and checked out the movie and it's still my favorite of his movies.
It's great, yeah. Did you see Vernon, Florida? It's
the yeah, short, similar.
Yeah, it's similar, yeah, I like that.
I feel like Gates of Heaven's more sort of focused.
So you must have worked closely with a cinematographer then to sort of try to capture some of that in Year of the Dog.
Yeah, we talked about it a lot. And what's funny is that some of my intentions, you know, like the truth was that like as the movie, there is a lot of story in the movie. And so some of the things that I wanted to try more experimental ideas in terms of just like letting, you know, some of those influences kind of like really like be evoked. Uh-huh. I had to like pull away from, and it ended up, you know, like some of this more stylistic, bolder stylistic decisions I ended up pulling back from in the editing, because there was just, the movie would have been way too long and kind of, you know, it just felt like it was like you, once the story kicks in, you just want to get to the story and you feel like you've really introduced those characters, you know what they are, so you don't really need to hear the whole monologue, you need to just get to the story. So I guess some of the conventions of narrative storytelling kind of superseded some of my own kind of like experimental ideas.
Is that the screenwriter side of you think doing that, pulling back a little, keeping the story intact?
Well, it's like, I mean, it's hard because each time you set out to do something, you have your own reasons for wanting to do it, your own kind of aesthetic goals, and you become more and more picky about what kind, the like from a narrative point of view, like what you like and what you don't like, so each time it becomes more and more, you become more and more particular, or at least I've found.
Time you mean like with each film?
Yeah, each script, just becomes, okay. I become more and more like, you know, like I have, you know, I don't know, you have a, and so it becomes more, the writing of something becomes more, you want to like raise your game for yourself, and it's a dialogue with yourself. It's hard to explain what that is, but like for you. And so like there was stuff that I really wanted to do with this from a screenwriting point of view. And then like, you know, the whole making the movie, and then the editing of the movie, they're all just different. You know, you realize that movie is not exactly that movie, which is not exactly, you know, the first movie. I guess like a true perfectionist would like, you know that the end game is the first, but like, you know, it just evolves as it goes along.
Yeah. Well, supposedly even Hitchcock changed things. Like, you know, there's this myth that Hitchcock would set everything down at the beginning in the script and the storyboards, and then his job was done. And he sort of furthered that myth, I think. But there's a lot of evidence that isn't true. That as with any film, that he changed things as he went along, and
it doesn't
make him any less of a filmmaker. But
yeah. Well, I definitely changed. I mean, all along I was just changing my game plan. And that was part of just being a director for the first time and realizing different things about filmmaking.
Yeah. Movies like Year of the Dog and The Good Girl and Chuck and Buck feel a lot more personal than the comedies you've made with Jack Black. Do you make that distinction? Are these two parallel tracks?
Well, what's weird is, I mean, I think the only movie that I've written that I don't think of as personal is Nacho Libre, because I wrote it with the Hesses and it was a little bit more like a party and not so much like self-expression.
Yeah.
But even like School of Rock was like, it definitely like has a more eye to a more kind of like broader audience, because that's just the nature of who's paying me and what, you know, I feel like I have to be responsible to that, you know.
Sure.
But at the same time, like, the fantasy of it is totally my own, you know, like, you know, being able to have creative control and a bunch of minions will do what you say, and like you get to like control the world and make it your, you know, like, so the lot of, you know, a lot of the, like, to me it is, it's the tone of it is like the tone of the other movies that you're talking about are a little bit more like reflect my my inner tone.
Uh-huh.
School of Rock is a little bit more winning, I guess, then I, you know, it's not the place I like to visit that place as much as I can, but I don't really, I mean, it's a little bit more, you know, it's like, I like movies that are a little, have a little bit of acid in them.
Is one more satisfying than the other?
No, I mean, I really like that people like School of Rock, and that, you know, it's like, but for me, it's more like the more people embrace it, the more like I feel like I'm in defensive mode, the more is the ones that are closer to me. Huh. Like the ones that are like, yeah, didn't like that one so much over there, because that's my favorite one. Fuck you.
Speaking of Nacho Libre, there aren't a lot of movies about, there aren't a lot of comedies about monks. Yeah, you've probably seen Flowers of St. Francis, the Rossellini movie.
Yeah.
You're in good company. That's all I'm saying.
Cool.
I heard an interview you did, this was quite a while ago, with Terry Gross, and you mentioned that you were a fan of art films at a strangely early age. Was that true?
Yeah, no, I'm.
Were there other things besides like Gates of Heaven that you had seen that you were hoping to incorporate in this first?
Well, when I was a kid, I was really, I wanted to like see sophisticated stuff. I don't know why, but like I was way more pretentious at 12 than I am now, I think, or just have a different sort of perspective on what I get out of things. But I think it all started like I said it in the Q&A yesterday, but like I had this teacher who I was really into, who was Sam Shepard's mother. So the first plays that I was reading were Sam Shepard plays because I was so into her or whatever. And so.
No, wait, how old were you? How old were you?
Well, that was in second grade. I didn't understand it, but I was like.
Very child.
Like,
I was
definitely like a kind of like, I would write little plays of like, you know, adults getting drunk and having affairs and, you know, having cocktail parties where they're like, you're sleeping with my wife. It was just like, I don't know where that was, like, but it was, I wish I had some of that crap. It wasn't like, you know, writing like, you know, action movies. You know, I did do that. There was some of that too, but like when I was left to my own devices, I would write these really like bananas, like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf ripoffs written from the point of view of like a 9-year-old kid, like, whatever.
A lot of directors say that casting is 70% of the job, or you know, pick your high percentage.
Right.
Did you find that to be true?
I mean, like, you know, like the script obviously is key, but like once, you know, like with these people, they just kind of, I mean, especially the way I wanted to shoot it was just really portraiture, just like kind of let it, you know, straight on, let the camera roll, just let them do their thing and not really, you know, get in there. And so the actors like really made it work, if it does work.
Oh, maybe you should mention some of the people who are in this movie. It's a great cast.
Yeah, it was like, well, Molly Shannon is the star, and then like the rest of the cast is awesome too. It's Laura Dern and Peter Sarsgaard and John Reilly and Regina King and Tom McCarthy and Josh Pice are like the main actors, and they were all just like so awesome. I got so lucky.
I think a lot of your movies, all of your movies have really great casts, really strong casts. Do you tend to write scripts with specific people in mind?
No, like with this one, none of those people did I write with them in mind, really. I thought Peter Sarsgaard, I've always thought maybe he could be that guy, but in this one, it was like Laura Dern and like Regina King are like two of my favorite actresses, just straight up, and I was just like, just go to the people that you really like and see if they like it. You know, I just got lucky that they wanted to do it. You know, sometimes I write with people in mind, like for a Jack Black movie, obviously I write it with Jack's voice. And with this, I wrote it for Molly, so I wanted her to do it.
Well, Year of the Dog seems to have been a hot ticket. I think people have been turned away at every screening so far.
Yeah, I know. We got lucky. People seem to be wanting to check it out. I think maybe they've heard it's... you know, I think there's so many really like, you know, bleak movies that, you know, a little antidote, maybe a little counter programming.
Well, I like how we were talking about some of your movies seem more personal and some are more sort of a lark.
Yeah.
But even the more personal ones are really funny. I think all of your movies are really funny.
Well, for me, it's like, I don't like things that are completely humorless because I don't feel like that's true of life, or at least in my life. It's like, I think even if you want to talk about like heavy things, like a little dose of comedy makes it more you know, entertaining for obviously, but it's also I think playfulness and wisdom go hand in hand, and sometimes.
Yeah, sure. So what's next?
I'm writing a script right now that I'm overdue. I'm doing something with Edgar Wright, who did Shaun of the Dead.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, so, but it's overdue. I got to write it. Toot sweet.
All right. Well, thanks very much for talking to me.
Awesome, man. Cool.
Please welcome the author, the artist, and the director of Persepolis, Marjan Satrapi. Marjan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Now, from what I understand, this is a wonderful film. It's getting wonderful notices. People are enjoying it. They're getting a greater understanding of the Iranian people. I think that's dangerous.
I'd like to start with a basic question about the novels themselves. Why did you choose that format rather than a traditional, you know, written autobiography or memoir?
Because I don't know how to write, actually. I mean, I know how to write, but, you know, for me, drawing is an extremely easy way to express myself. For me, the drawing, I mean, pictures and the text goes together. And if I have the possibility to and draw and write, I mean, why should I choose between one and another? Plus that, you know, this way of expressing myself is really what fits me the best, because I think by images.
Mm. How did you decide on this artistic style that you used?
Well, it was a little bit, you know, it's a matter of lots of things. First of all, you know, in a comic, the drawing is part of the narration. It's not illustration of the text that you have already written. So the thing that you don't write, you draw them, and vice versa. So it's really narrative. So if you have a text that is heavy, you have a lots of word, etc., etc., if the drawing, they're also very heavy, with lots of background, with lots of perspective, one, and very complicated, each new thing that you add is a code that you have to read. And it's a question of rhythm of reading. So I always believe if the story is very complicated, I had to get easy, you know, on the drawing. Because otherwise, you know, it is heavy over heavy, it becomes difficult to digest. Also, you know, I mean, in the first book, you know, the thing that differs, you know, a drawing in a comic book than in a normal illustration is a notion of movement, because you always have to have the movement. To know the movement, you have to know very good about anatomy. I didn't know very good about anatomy because, you know, all our study that I was, you know, that was still life images, you know, we didn't have so much possibility. So in the first book, by coincidence, I draw like a kid because I couldn't draw better. And in the last book, I start drawing like a grown up, because the more you draw, the better you draw. So by coincidence, it became better and better. And, you know, they were calling this style, you know, a false naive style. That was nothing false about the naivety of my style. It was just the way it was. Mm. So, yeah. So it was this conjecture of these two.
In an interview you did a few years ago, you stated how difficult it is for an Iranian to answer the question, where do you come from? And that you remarked that, you know, now that you can just point people to the book.
Yes.
Was that part of your reason for writing the books, to help yourself answer that question, do you think?
No, for me, you know, when I came, you know, I heard so many things. I mean, misunderstanding, but also crazy things. You know, I mean, I don't say that what is shown on the TV is all crap. This is not true. I mean, this is part of the reality, but that is just a part of the reality. You have all the other realities that nobody is aware of. You know, that is like these images that they showed from America in France, you know, that everybody was calling French fries freedom fries and all the French fries. Of course that happened. What did that happen in the whole country? Was everybody calling French fries freedom fries? But the way it was showed in France, that was like, we had the feeling that, you know, we would go to McDonald's and we would have a big burger, you know, with some freedom fries, yeah, you know, and yeah, we would make, you know, freedom keys to our boyfriend and et cetera, et cetera. For me, that was also important, you know, to give at least another version of the story. That is not the other version of the story, because I'd never put myself, you know, I don't have this pretension that I'm a historian or a politician or something like that. Far from that. I'm a person that is born in a certain place, in a certain time, that has seen things And these things that she has seen doesn't correspond to the thing that is described in the press, because you read the press, you see the television, you have the feeling that these Iranians, they're wild people, all their anti-West, the whole goal in their life is to come and destroy United States of America. I mean, it's not me saying that. All the researchers, sociological researchers, show us, for example, that the Iranian population are the most pro-Western people in the whole Middle East. But this, nobody has a clue over that. Because if you start talking about this thing, if you start saying these people, they're just normal people, then it's very difficult to go and bomb them, you know. Mm. It's much easier to reduce people to some abstract notion, because then we forget that they're human beings.
Absolutely.
They forget they are like us.
Yeah.
If we make this identification, then it's very difficult.
Mm.
It's when we think that people, they're really not like us,
yeah.
Then you go and you bomb them.
That's right.
And you kill them and nobody cares because they are not like you.
And so how did the film come about then?
Well, the film was really not my idea. Mm. I mean, I never thought it was a good idea to make a movie, because it looked like this like business plan. Like, you know, I made a book that worked, now let's make a movie that works, etc. And, you know, cinema and comics is really two different narration. Mm. It's two different media.
Absolutely.
It's not definitely because you're a good cartoonist that you will be a good director.
Right.
It has
right.
nothing to do. And I was aware of that. But it was really a situation that a friend of mine, you know, wanted to become a producer as an artist. You know, suddenly I had the possibility of doing something. The money was there, you know, because in France we don't make the movie like here. You know, the financing is really different. You know, it was not a big budget. I mean, the whole movie costed about $8 million. And, you know, 2 years ago, it was about $6 million. But, you know, now with the rate of euro and dollar, I had to make it update. But, you know, it's $8 million movie. It's not, you know, for an animation movie. When you know that it's about 100 people working for almost 2 years, you understand that it's not so much money. But, you know, I could have a studio. I could exactly do what I wanted. And, you know, I had just the curiosity of saying, okay, I will try, with this idea that, you know, the worst thing that can happen is that I make a very bad movie.
Yeah.
What's the big fuss, you know, what's the problem?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not dead. I can continue doing other stuff. But at the same time, I always have the feeling that if for 2 years I try something, I have learned something. And from the moment I learned, I can never say that I have lost something. I learned. So no matter what the result is, I'm winning something.
Yeah.
No matter what is the result, good or bad movie, I will be a winner in this game. So
how was it working with your co-director, Vincent?
But Vincent, you know, Vincent, he was my best friend before being the co-director. We always wanted to work together. But, you know, in order to work together, you have to have a common project.
Mm.
So when that came, you know, I spoke to him and I asked him if he wanted to be part of it. And he said yes. And the fact was that, you know, we really co-wrote the scenario. It was not like I made the first draft and then he made the second draft. It was not like that. We saw each other every day for 4 or 5 months in the same cafe, you know, by our studio. For 5 hours, we worked between 6:30 in the morning, you know, and 11, something like that, because that was a moment that was not so many people there. We wrote with a pencil because we didn't know how to type. So, you know, we wrote it with a pencil. We were playing it together. And then, you know, and then the whole thing, on whatever decision we made, it has always been the decision that has been taken from both of us. Mm. It was layer of information, like he would say something, I would say something, I would say something, he would say something, etc. That's the way it worked.
And how did you decide which events from the books to include in the movie and which to leave out?
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, in the book you have plenty of space, yeah. And you can just go and say whatever, you can take your time. When you have a 1.5 hour movie, if you want to put 16 years of one life in 1.5 hour movie, then you can also find yourself with 5 movies in one, which
right.
is a complete disaster. You should never do that.
Yep.
So you always have to choose an axis. So at the time that you started writing the script, I was in a very nostalgic period of my life.
Mm.
So the thing was that the way it happened is that we made this whole structure that is based on a flashback because of this nostalgia. You know, this woman that goes to the airport doesn't have any ticket to go back. She sees and she remembers her life. So that was the axis of that nostalgia. And, you know, the whole structure went on this flashback. Then, you know, the turning point of the story became the exile. everything brings to this exile, and from this exile, you know, this exile actually justify whatever happened next. Yep. So we had to choose an axis like that, you know. For me, one of the best examples like that, that is the Jean-Jacques Annaud and the Name of the Rose. You know, the Umberto Eco book is very much about philosophy and whatever, you know, the religious thing, you know, in the Middle Ages, etc. Jean-Jacques Annaud, he had the intelligence of choosing, you know, this detective side of the story. Because if you want to talk about all this thing that is going in a philosophical and sociological and all the layer that is in Umberto Eco's book, then you find yourself with the nonsense. He made the right decision. He took one direction. Yep. And that's why the movie is a good movie. And yeah. Still it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it was my mood that day, but the film strikes me as somewhat funnier than the book. There's some funny parts in the book, but the film itself is quite funny. Was that intentional on your part?
Yes, because, you know, I mean, since the movie is funnier and at the same time is darker.
Yes, it is.
It's also more violent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you have more darkness and more violence, you always is a question of equilibrium again. You know, this whole idea that, you know, people in one side of the world all the time they suffer, that doesn't exist, you know. Total happiness doesn't exist, but total sadness doesn't exist neither. Especially when you are living a situation of war, that is the first time that you become intelligent enough to know that each second you might lose your life. That should be always like that, but we forget that. But when you are living at this very, you know, incredible moment, too violent, you are really, you're in front of it each second. And then you know that, you know, life is too short. So, you know, as soon as you can laugh, you do. As soon as you can make a party, you do. As soon as, you know, you can enjoy, you do, because life is short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet the movie ends, I think, on a somewhat sad note, and so I was curious why you chose to end the movie there, you know, with
it's you. It's sad because you know, I mean, when you decide to go, it's part of you that you leave. Mm. I mean, I don't want to complain because, of course, you know, I have a great life. I live where I want with who I want. You know, I'm successful. Blah blah blah. I mean, if I start to complain, it becomes indecent. I mean, 90% of the people in the world, they can even not eat decently. So if we have a life like mine, then sit and complain is not nice. But at the same time, it's something is that when you live like that, it's always half of you that you have to live somewhere. Because if I want to live in France, I cannot just come with my, you know, with my background luggage, you know, and bring it all the time, because then, you know, the relationship is impossible. People, they have their own life and they don't want to have that all the time in their face. That I can completely understand it. So it's part of me that is that, you know, I just have to shut down. You know, like I go to parties, you know, I mean, you know, people, they're sitting, you know, they're my age, they're 37, 38, and they talk about, you know, these great things that they love to watch at TV. I didn't watch the same stuff. So I just laugh, but, you know, that is something that I can never share with people. Mm. And these are many things like that, you know, that is not possible. Mm. So, of course, there's something sad about it.
Mm. There's a wonderful scene early in the film about your love of Bruce Lee. And I was curious, did you watch a lot of movies growing up?
Oh, I watched lots of movies growing up. Not only I went very often to cinema. That was with my parents. That was also with my bigger cousin. You know, I was very much a big fan of Bruce Lee. Because, you know, I mean, from the third world, you know, mm-hmm. basically, you have two heroes that are internationally known. Yeah. One is Bruce Lee. Yeah. The other one is the reggae singer, Bob Marley. Yeah. That is these two guys that come from, you know, the third world countries, and they're internationally known. I mean, Iran is in Asia, so, you know, Bruce Lee was even a bigger deal. Yeah. And I thought that he was so good looking. I still think so. He was very handsome. Later on, I realized that he was the teacher of Steve McQueen. That made him even more, even better in my brain.
Did Iranian cinema influence you much?
Not really. Mm. Not really, because, you know, I mean, basically, the only thing that is between me and the Iranian cinema is the fact that we are Iranian. You know, Iranian cinema, it's not that I don't appreciate it. I love Iranian cinema. And Iranian cinema, you know, that's a cinema that exists since 1900. You know, I mean, it's a long history of cinema. And that was great movies even before the revolution that nobody talks about them. But anyway, it is a real cinema. The thing is that, you know, Iranian cinema is based of symbolism. And there's a reason to that, because you're in a country when you cannot just go and say exactly directly what you want. So you have to turn it in a way so it goes into a lot of metaphor and symbolism, which is great and which is extremely beautiful. The way that I deal with this subject is really frontal.
Yeah.
So starting from there is not the same thing. You know, and also it's something, you know, I'm 38 years old, and half of my life I have not lived it in Iran. So, you know, so it changed you. I mean, if you have lived, you know, sometimes in Austria and, you know, sometimes in France, and you're married to a Swedish guy and and then I can, you know, it changes you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One commonality I happen to see, though, is that, as in a lot of Iranian cinema, and very much in your film, there's this really great capturing of childhood and,
yes,
and the passion and the naivete of childhood, but
yes,
also the fact that you understand that children understand a lot more than I think adults give them credit for.
Yes, but I think that this thing of the childhood is because of the incredible love that we receive from our parents.
Mm.
I mean, the Iranian parents, I don't say that the other parents, they don't love their children, huh? But they don't love us, you know, they adore us, you know, it's like we are the king. When you're a child over there, I mean, if when you have loving parents, it's like, you know, you just rule. And this is something extremely great, especially, you know, for my case. Imagine, my mother was the favorite child of her parents. My father was the favorite child of his parents. These both of them, they married, and they had this only child, me. So, you know, I grew up with the idea that I was the center of the universe. Thanks God I went to Sweden, to Austria, and I had like 50 slap in my face one after the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hold my horses after that.
Yeah.
And I understood that that was many other people that were center of the universe. But yeah, but I think it is because our childhood is so much, all of us, we have such a loving childhood, you know. You're the center of interest when you are a child over there.
You've touched on this a little bit, but I thought I'd ask the question more directly. Much has been made, at least here in the United States, about the conflict between Islam and the West. I was wondering if you would describe it as a conflict.
There is no conflict. There is no conflict because, you know, if you have a fanatic, they call that an Islamist. But a Christian fanatic, they don't call that a Christianist. Or a Jewish fanatic, we don't call that a Judaist. You know, there is no conflict between East and West, between Islam and Christianity, because, you know, Islam exists since 1,400 years and Christianity exists since 2,000 years. I mean, it cannot suddenly be something that has been, is a conflict in the world between the fanatics and the rest of the people. And believe me, the fanatics all over the world are the same. The American fanatic equal Iranian fanatic, equal Saudi Arabian fanatic, equal Israeli fanatic, equal Sikh fanatic in India. All these people, they are the same. They're the people that go from the idea that if you are not with them, you are against them. And then that is other people like you, like myself, and all of that. I mean, it's not necessarily because somebody is American that he will be your best friend. I mean, if you have this fanatic American pro-Bush, I mean, you would say, who is this guy? He's a total foreigner to you. It's the same thing, you know, from a fanatic of Iran. I mean, yeah, we speak the same language, but I understand what he's talking about. You know, the question is that, the question is between that. The line is there. One side you have the fanatics and the other side you have the normal people. That is where the conflict is. There is not such a conflict. And, you know, but it's extremely dangerous, this whole, you know, stigma that is around, you know, these Muslim people. It is very much like what happened in the 30s in Europe about the Jews, you know, that they had a nose like that and all of that. Now the description of the Muslim is not far from that. They have a beard and they are like this and they are like that. I mean, I know a lot of people that consider themselves as Muslim and they're just cool, you know, and they drink and, you know, they go out and, you know, it's not because, you know, you're a Muslim and that, you know, you want to destroy the, you have a few of them, they exist, but they are not so many. We should never, ever forget that. They are not so many. And if we start, you know, pressing, you know, showing them the finger, is something extremely dangerous. Mm-hmm. By giving a name and an address to evil, saying the evil are these people. That is the beginning of the fascist idea. Because if the evil is an ethnic, if it's a religion, if it's a place in the world, then we have to go and execute all of them. And like that, we, the good people, we will live between each other. The tone is so high that we have to cool down a little bit, you know. We have just to cool down, to be a little bit, you know, just to take a step back. That's what I try to do. I don't have any answer to give. I just try to take a step back, to ask the question, just to understand that the things are much more complex. Because believe me, the day that I came out of Iran, I was so much angry. I was so much full of hate. And thanks God, it took me a long time before I wrote my book, because then I was not hateful anymore, and I was not angry anymore. Because if I started writing before that, then I would be exactly like the people that I accuse.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Errata Movie Podcast. I hope you'll check out these two movies. They're both a little bit funny and a little bit sad, but maybe you'll enjoy them. I know I'm one of the few people to put Year of the Dog on my best of list for 2007, but I did notice that none other than Philip Lopate included it in his top 10, along with Syndromes in a Century. So I'm in good company there. Persepolis, of course, is showing up on lots of lists, and we'll see how it does at the Oscars this weekend. Me, I'm still hoping that Syndromes in a Century is going to pull out that Best Picture win. Now, people who are more familiar than I am with the rules say that that's not really possible. But I say until the votes are counted, no one knows the answer to that. So, fingers crossed. We'll be back next week to talk about our favorite films of 2007 and finally put a cap on that year. We keep saying we're going to do it. We really are. We really are. That's next time. In the meantime, please visit us on the web at erotamag.com/podcast. There you can leave us a comment, or you can send us email if you prefer, feedback@erotamag.com. That's erratamag.com. Or if you want to call, 415-287-4020, you can leave a voicemail and we'll listen to it. Also, send in for your free decoder ring. We'll be back next week to chat.